This is a Collider.com audio interview.
The three dimensions sit in that space can be a little better, but honestly, if I hadn't done other visual effects movies, I'd call that a final. It's just like, I'm nitpicking because I know my whole team is nitpicking, but like, I'll be honest, when they showed me that one, I was like, that looks fucking awesome. I'm like, fuck. So that's like 80%. And it's not say that the last 20% will be noticeable even, but obviously, you know, everyone who's working at their individual jobs in the movie want to do it as well as they humanly can. So, and you can hear the sound work in there, right? So that's why I showed it. What else, guys?
Well, from a purely nerdy point of view, what is Noisy Boy's sound? Does he have, is he like jet engines mixed with something else? Is it other stuff?
Let me, I know that we have some, because I remember Craig told me a bunch of them, like, oh, that is really good, like DVD stuff. Yeah. Just kind of anecdotal. Let me, I'll track you down and get you the answers before Thursday. Because I don't recall now, but I remember thinking, like, what? You went to the desert and recorded a blender? It was weird, weird kind of, like, sounds like that. Because the challenge for any really kind of top sound guy is no library sounds, right? Like, no library sounds, create them all from scratch without, you know, like, nothing out of the box. I mean, everything out of the box.
I have to ask, was there ever any thought about Ben Burtt?
Not, I would say, a meaningful one, but... Also, just, I guess every, well, in terms of just involvement and...
Oh, I mean, he has a little history with droids.
Yeah.
And robots.
Not, I would say, a real one. Also, like, I don't know that I could give notes to someone that I revere. It's always hard. That's a general challenge of directing, is giving notes to people you revere. The other kind of, I think, big contribution to this, which most people who I show some footage to take note, is, like, I think Mauro Fiore's cinematography is unbelievable. Like, it's because I made clear to Mauro, I want your tech savvy from Avatar, but the look of this is more Training Day than Avatar. And indeed, I think that he found a way to do that kind of like gritty, saturated world without it feeling kind of polished and cotton candy-ish.
Is this 3D?
It's not.
It
is now IMAX.
On your part?
Yeah, it was me, it was Steven. To be very honest with you, there were two big factors. One was that we were initially coming out in that week before Thanksgiving, where both Twilight and Happy Feet are coming out, and it was within a month where you have Puss in Boots 3D, Happy Feet 3D. There's like four 3D movies, and I had availability concerns of screens. And again, if the movie was 80% robot boxing, I probably would have pushed harder for 3D. But because it's really more like 30% robot boxing and 70% kind of, not unlike the first Rocky, which really is 20% boxing, 80% like that underdog redemption story. That's definitely the kind of structural, or just the ratio model here. And I didn't know, like, a lot of the scenes are like the one you saw with Evangeline and Hugh, and I just don't know that you're servicing that kind of movie with 3D. So no, but IMAX now, because the good news is, since we moved, we're no longer coming out the same weekend as Happy Feet 2, we're going to get a nice, juicy IMAX release in October, which is when we're coming out now.
When you say IMAX, a lot of times with IMAX movies, they will fill up the frame with the robot. Like, what I'm saying is, will the robot boxing scenes, like, fill up the entire IMAX frame, or will you have, like, those lines in the top and bottom?
I went through this on one of the Night at the Museums, where, and I think in the end, we filled up the frame rather than masking it. I've not yet had those conversations with IMAX. Until I see how it stretches, how, you know, kind of, I'm on the fence, is the answer now. But I'm so early, I haven't even talked about the kind of technical specs of how we do that release.
So what's the, in your head, you have a tone, you have a lot of ways you could play with this, and tonally, I think, and you have the robot, you know, I think it could have easily been like a kid's film, or it could be a dark, gritty,
yes,
you know, violent drama. So where are you sitting as far as...
I'd really like to think... that's a good question. I'm trying to, I guess, accomplish both. I'm trying to make a movie that on a pure kind of badass barometer is just fucking cool. Like, that if what you're looking for is just a crazy fucking badass robot boxing movie, hopefully the movie you know, has the goods to be enjoyable on that level. But I would argue that even in the most jaded cinephile heart, there beats, you know, a kind of a humanity and a desire to actually have an escapist emotional experience at the movies. One that we can admire aesthetically and kind of participate viscerally in. And so the goal here, and we've had some early small screenings where this seems to be kind of happening, is that you come in thinking, oh, you're going to see a cool robot boxing movie. You don't expect this emotional underdog father-son movie. And it's not one that's kind of soft and kind of overly sentimental, but hopefully it's one that's poignant. So in that regards, I guess I'm hoping, it's definitely not a kiddie movie, but I'm hoping that it has, I mean, I'm trying to think of examples of movies where, like, it's always dangerous to compare yourself to other movies, but the goal is definitely to appeal to a wide span of audience members. So hopefully just accomplish both those. Genuinely kind of rousing and emotional, but also just fucking cool.
You mentioned Danny Elfman for score, but as I was walking in, I saw Tom Morello walking out. So I have to ask you. I will use anything I can. Tom Morello was here.
He was.
I got here. I got here a little early. Yeah. So let's throw the question out there. What are you thinking about for songs for these different robot boxing scenes? And also, I want to do a follow up and say how many. Like you mentioned, 30% for boxing scenes, but are there? Could you sort of put a number on how many different scenes are there? Are there, you know, long, short?
Yep. I'll do the first question first. If you go to any fight, whether MMA or boxing, there's like a whole kind of musical soundscape to these events. There's pre-event pump-up, psych-up music. There's fighter introductions. There's between rounds. So what my musical needs are really, really diverse. So there's the whole sound of Hugh Jackman's character is very kind of like acoustic-based singer-songwriter, lonely soul, basically traveling the American landscape. Not unlike, by the way, eventually we should talk about the Matheson story, because the deeper I am in the movie, it occurred to me to share with you guys how much of that short story is in this movie in terms of a truly desperate protagonist who will do near anything for a break, for one redemptive fight, one redemptive moment. So there's kind of singer-songwriter, guitar-driven stuff for Hugh, but I'd say in the venues themselves, there's a heavy hip-hop quotient. I mean, I'm talking with artists that you didn't see here today. But of that caliber, at kind of the highest caliber of you know, hip-hop, both performers and producers, because I just feel like there's going to be a big kind of aspect. So a heavy dose of hip-hop music, and you saw Tom, his stuff, you know, there's the rage stuff. But then there's also the stuff he's done with Crystal Method, for instance, which, like, I mean, Name of the Game, which is one of the great fucking, like, Tom's work is so kind of horizontally spread that his stuff, to be honest, I looked at 5 different scenes with Tom, you know, and it's like, I show my work to him, he's like, oh no, I think I would start with some guitar and then let it build, and then boom, drop the beat when they come into the arena here. And so it was just kind of like a preliminary concept, like jam session. And I'd say it's probably equally split between hip hop and rock, with a slight no, that's inaccurate. I would say it's more hip hop and even electronic than it is straight up rock. There's probably one fight out of the 6 major fight sequences that will be straight up rock. The rest would be, it might be a kind of a hip hop track with an angry guitar kind of hook, or it might be in the case of, like, you take some of Crystal Method stuff, who is also there coming to the editing room next weekend, or next week, is like, they're looking at this because, like, when Noisy Boy gets introduced, that's Weapons of Mass Destruction by Crystal Method, they're going to look at maybe doing something new for that slot. So I think that it's eclectic because every fighter has its own sound, every fighter has its own soundtrack. So that's the answer as far as musical breadth. Fight-wise, 1, 2, 3, 4. Whoa, someone waved their hands for the infrared. The movie has 5 major fight sequences and two kind of significant montage sequences with snippets of various fights. And I would say some of the fights are, you know, 2.5 minutes long. Some of the fights are 10 minutes long. I'll let you guess where in the movie those running times fall.
So editing is almost done? I mean, you're fine-tuning?
No, what I'm doing, I'm fine-tuning. My official director's cut ends next week. But I showed the first 40 minutes to Stephen already. And that was profoundly encouraging. That was really, really encouraging. Because it included Crash Palace, which I showed you as the first robe on a robe fight, but it played through the next sequence, which is when we discover our protagonist robot, which I probably would have shown you, but the studio was like, Sean, you're showing them a third of the movie, chill. So they assured me you guys can come back, maybe when we go with the full trailer in the summer. I'm presenting the full movie. I'm going to watch it with the studio in a week and a half.
So, no pressure.
Yeah. No pressure. But honestly, getting through, like, showing Steven that first 40 minutes, because I needed to make sure that my instincts for how I wanted these robots to fight and move and be sunk with his own kind of, you know. And so it was some gut check going on, and we were on exactly the same page, which was very, very encouraging.
Well, talking of Steven, we were actually in... Some of us were actually in the edit bay for I Am Number 4 this morning, and DJ was talking about how Steven's so good at identifying story beats, sort of like helping people, you know, work out if he's got one scene he wants to shoot, do one way, maybe cut it the other way.
Yeah.
What sort of that does he bring to you as well? Is it also like human stuff? You can run past him, you can go, you know, does it feel emotionally right to you? Like, because he has some experience.
Well, look, there is, while it doesn't skew this young or soft, you know, if you saw that sizzle reel in Detroit, you know there's a shades of kind of an E.T. strand here, in that this is about, you know, on one level, this is about that kid, that lost, damaged boy, that finds a creature that is a transformative relationship for him. So in that regard, I would argue that anyone roughly my age is a kind of, you know, filmic descendant of Stevens. To some extent, to be able to get the benefit of the 101 has been great. So for me on this movie, he was hugely helpful in creature design. Just kind of, and again, Steven will have really tweaky notes, like a Noisy Boy, which you've now seen a few scenes. His whole thing was like, look at his hips. His hips are off. And there was a whole kind of like rethink on his hips and thigh girth. Because Steven's like, look at the size of his shoulders. If he has that much kind of torso weight, there's no way his hips could support it. The pivot point, central axis with the quantum gimbal. Okay, like I just threw out 7 words I barely understand, but Steven uses them in full confidence. And so like he'll kind of get either really macro and go like, yeah, Noisy Boy's hips need to be wider and his thighs need to be beefier. But then I'll show him, say, that first 40 minutes and I'll ask him things like, just, what'd you think of Hugh? How did Hugh feel? Like, does he feel too much like an asshole to this kid? Does he feel, too cynical, too, and so, like, kind of global, you know, Stephen once paid me a huge compliment in an article about me last year. He said something like, that I direct as if I'm sitting in the audience. That's kind of, and I've always felt that Stephen's greatest strength is his just audience instincts are kind of unparalleled. And so if I'm trying to tap any big aspect of him, it's that. Is that enough for today?
Well, I can always ask more questions.
I know you could.
I'm one of those guys.
Should we do one more question, or if anyone has something pressing? Otherwise,
I've asked a lot. I feel like, okay, I've dominated.
No, if you have another one, you
want. I think everyone's actually spoken.
Yeah, you have. You said, Sean, you said you did some screening with the audience?
Not that these were just what I always... Yeah, yes is the answer, but they're small, like 25 person. What I always do is, before I show the studio, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, at some point, if anyone cared, there's a very interesting article or symposium to be held, I think, on just the real difference between comedy filmmaking and non-comedy. Because, you know, when you work in comedy, you depend on audience screenings to tell you about your movie. When you do a drama, you are challenged to trust your inner voice much more. Because when you put a comedy in front of even a 25-person screening, you know whether it's working or not. The barometer is overt. If it's quiet, guess what? The shit ain't working. If it's fucking filled with laughter, it's working. Something like this, you're really kind of feeling it in the room, but it really, I found it very interesting just on a filmmaking level. It's been such a kind of game-changing experience for me to kind of feel and experience the movie in a much more contemplative internal way, because you don't have that clear read from the audience. So I've had a couple of internal screenings. I always do that before I show the studio. Simple things like, do you understand how the robots move? Like, you want to get out in front of those questions. Or do you think, does a movie skew too cynical? Does a movie skew too young? So I kind of, and we learned some interesting things, and I subsequently tweaked, you know, just kind of balancing the relationship between Hugh and the kid, balancing the relationship between Hugh and Evangeline, how much flirtation do we want, how much friendship, things like that. But it'll be the studio screening in the middle of this month, and then the big decision, of course, as always, is whether you preview, because, as you well know, within an hour of the lights coming up, the world will know about my fucking not yet finished movie. And it's interesting because I've never made the kind of movie that bloggers particularly care about, right? Because most of my movies have been made for, frankly, people who are too young to not have password protection on their computers. But like, this one is just, it's been a real kind of, something I've already started talking with Steven and with Stacey Snyder at the studio. It's like, we want to learn about the movie, and yet it just becomes such public knowledge, you know?
Intimate screenings is the key.
I think so, right?
If you do 300 people screenings, it's over.
Yeah.
But I have one follow-up.
Sure.
Is this movie possible without... Could this movie have been made without Transformers being made? Because there's obviously robot... I mean, you have to talk about that. The fact that robots are a big part, and maybe they learned a lot through animating Bay's movies.
I have no... Yeah, I mean, the truth is, much of my process on this movie is in making sure these feel utterly distinct. So in the design of them, the scale of them, and their movements, and even their operating systems, making sure there's no Transformers confusion. But there's no question that I'm making the movie with a sensitivity to what the audience has experienced already, and I'm sure that technologically we benefited greatly from that. But I would argue that we benefited mostly from Avatar. I mean, truly, doing this movie without motion capture and simulcam B playback, that I can't imagine. So I think we benefited from coming after, you know, Transformers, but this is so different from Transformers in so many key ways that it's Avatar that comes to my mind. Like, my debt to Cameron is huge. But there's no question that you don't make a robot movie and kind of bury your head in the sand, oblivious to all the ones that have come before you. And it's probably why I'm trying to get the tone as specific as I am, and I know I keep talking about it, but you get it. If you were directing this movie, you would want to make sure it's its own beast.
And one other thing. Yeah. I know. It's always me. You mentioned simulcam, and we sort of know what it is, but could you sort of explain it so we can write about it?
Yep. You capture boxers in data sensing pajama suits. You store the movements of the fights. You then go to a real fight venue 6 months later, and when I line up my camera on a real ring in the real world, I am able to play back the fight that I captured half a year earlier. I'm able to play it back in my camera and on my monitors from any possible angle. What I see is played back and recalibrated to the angle that I choose on that day. So that simulcam B. That's pretty concise, too. I'm not even a techie. I am now.
And that's why you say Avatar.
That's why I say Avatar. Yeah. I mean, because it's the simulcam playback. You know, Avatar did it in a few different ways where, you know, they were able to play back their captured performances in the created world of Pandora. This movie is significantly different in that we are playing back captured performances in the non-virtual world of this movie, in a real-world setting, but an instant comp of a real setting with a previously captured fight. Okay? And you know that, like, Sugar Ray Leonard was the consultant on the boxing choreography. And
we now do.
The fights were, Ray, it is funny, though. What's funny is, like, I don't know if you remember. You probably do, because for me, one of the funniest moments in that Crash Palace fight is when, you know, it's like all this fucking, it's some boxing, it's some MMA moves, and then all of a sudden, Midas drops down to his knee and does a full-on straight arm to the non-balls of, you know, in the, and that was when Ray came to the boxing gym and he watched it. He's like, you know, it would be just crazy because you could never, ever do it with humans. And that, so among the many contributions of Sugar Ray Leonard was the full-on straight right to the balls of Noisy Boy, which I thought was funny, like, because I'm expecting all kinds of crazy, like, technical boxer stuff, and in addition to that, I got the punch to the balls, which is pretty funny. So, yeah, I will get you those sound tidbits, and I'm sure I'll see you guys again.